So good morning again. In the second part of the talk, I will continue where I left yesterday. So I will not reintroduce grid cells and place cells, but ask about their relationship. So the first part of the talk will discuss the possible relationships between cells in entorhinal cortex and hippocampus, after which I will discuss relationships to the lateral entorhinal cortex and the role of temporal synchronization between those areas in learning. That's unpublished work, and then I will go to some other, even more unpublished work, it's even more preliminary, so, which is points to a role for the nucleus reunions in CA1 place fields. And finally, I will go back to some really old stuff, trying to bring in the role of grid cells in memory. So that's the most speculative part. Okay, so we go almost 10 years back to the grid cells, 2005. So when we observed these grid cells, one of the first things that happened was, of course, that both we and many others asked, what is there a relationship between these cells and the place cells in the hippocampus? And because these grid cells were most prominent and most periodic, regular, in the layer 2 of medial entorhinal cortex and also in layer 3, then it was not unreasonable to suggest that they might provide some sort of input to the place cells. So this led us and others to suggest that the place cells arise as a result of some sort of transformation, Fourier transformation, where place cells are generated simply by a summation of inputs from grid cells of different wavelengths, but with a common central common phase or overlapping phase, and then also differences in orientation. So if you add up these inputs, you get single place fields, more or less. You can see it in one dimension here. So the point is that because the wavelengths are different, you end up with, they cancel and you get up with a single field. So this was obviously a very simple idea, and I'm happy to say that it's I think it's wrong, but it's too simple. Then...
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So grid cells have to arise as a Fourier transform of space, right? There's no grid, as somebody pointed out yesterday, in the outside world.
Sorry, once more.
The grid cells themselves,
yeah,
basically a Fourier transform of place cells. Not maybe place cells in campus, but Fourier transform of place.
Yeah.
And so why wasn't it possibly the other way around? Was it just purely because of anatomy? That
Yeah, so it is... it is possible, in principle, the other way around, because it's a loop. And that is that really complicates it all, because it's a loop, it gets much harder to think. But yes, the distance between the place cells, between the grid cells and the place cells, that is just one synapse. So at least in the standard anatomical model, you go from layers 2, 3 to hippocampal cells, it's one step. Whereas if you go back in the standard view, then at least you have to go through the deep layers of entorhinal cortex. So it's one step more. Doesn't exclude that there could be grid cells can be generated from place cells, but at least it's a bit more difficult.
From a normative point of view, it's a pretty dumb thing to do, right? Because you naturally have space in the outside world, even if you're getting a hippocampus. To turn it to Fourier transform to the grid cells, Fourier transform back into the place cells, just a noisy process. Of course, if I designed the brain, it wouldn't work. But
yeah. No, no. But I will come back to that at the end of the talk, because there may be reasons for doing this that is not related to just making a single field. I don't think that is the main reason for doing it. The reason for doing it is more at the network level, where you actually can generate maps or representations that are completely orthogonal unlike these ones. But that's the topic of the last 15 minutes, so just remind me them again.
The quiet, we'll get to this last 15 minutes.
All right, but let me get started, because this is just introduction, and there are many, many complications. So one of them is that grid cells are not the only inputs to the place cells or to the hippocampus. We learned very soon that that there are also head direction cells. As you have heard many times, head direction cells were discovered long ago by Jim Rank and Taub and his colleagues. And what Jim found in the presubiculum, dorsal presubiculum, was that there are cells that fire specifically to the head direction of the animal. So they don't really have any spatial correlates, but they fire specifically when the head is pointing, when the animal is pointing a certain direction. So these cells intermingle with grid cells. They are preferentially in deeper layers, so they don't, in at least in the rats, they don't intermingle completely, but they are part of the same interconnected network. And then in addition, there's even more. There are border cells, which you heard a lot about yesterday from Neil. So cells that fire along specific walls of the environment, one or several. If you introduce walls, you get a copy of the peripheral wall, so that is maybe a hallmark of these cells. Those cells fire in relation to borders whatsoever. We have not been able ever to get these cells to do anything else, like grid cells, so we have also not been able to get the grid cell to become a border cell. So they seem to be quite distinct cells. And finally, these also intermingle with I should perhaps say that these are also quite common in layer 2, possibly isolated anatomically from grid cells, because they appear to, quite often, they appear in patches, but with tetrode recordings, we aren't really able to resolve that, so that will have to await work on other techniques.
But these are pyramidal cells in layer 2?
Hmm?
These are pyramidal cells in layer 2?
Well, that's an open question, because we can't tell. I do think they are, but that's still a possibility, because pyramidal cells appear both in the deeper part of layer 2, but also in certain islands. There was two papers about that last week. So, but the bottom line is that those islands consist of pyramidal cells and may possibly correspond to these, but I don't know. Finally, there are the speed cells, which I mentioned yesterday, which also are intermingled, at least if you consider several layers among these cells. So all of these may project to the hippocampus, possibly. Whether they do is not an obvious question, because not all layer 2 cells of the entorhinal cortex project to the hippocampus. So there's been a lot of work on that very recently, and also especially a paper by Varga et al. From Ivan Soltis' group, which suggests that there are at least two classes of layer 2 cells. So it's the reelin positive cells that project into the hippocampus, and then there are the reelin negative, calbindin positive cells, the pyramidal cells that project elsewhere. So it's not obvious which cells actually project into the hippocampus, but not unlikely more than just the grid cells that I mentioned in the beginning. And in addition, it's further complicated by the developmental trajectory of these cells, because if grid cells are the sole origin of place cells, then you would expect them to appear at least more or less simultaneously, or possibly the grid cells before, but not the other way around. And there were two studies, one from our lab. Langston, Rose Langston was the key person there, and another study from Tom Wills and O'Keefe and Neil and others in London at UCL, which essentially showed the same, which was, first of all, for place cells, if you record from place cells as soon as the animals can walk or start walking outside the nest, then place cells are more or less normal. They're less stable and so, but actually they look quite place-like right from the beginning. And if you use quantitative criteria to count the place cells, it doesn't really increase a lot with age. So they are there from the beginning. And this is in contrast to the grid cells, which mature much later. So in our hands, they don't really appear adult-like until you're around 4 weeks of age. In London, it was slightly before, but the exact timing isn't really important. What matters is that in the beginning, there are much fewer grid cells, and those that pass the criteria look really not very nice, really. It's less periodic than in the adult brain. So that poses a possible problem, because if it's just if the original model of where place cells were just generated by a simple transformation from grid cells, if that were true, then you would should expect less stable or less at least not so sharp place cells in the hippocampus.
Can you look at intracellular energy from place cells? And then if that superposition of grid cells is true, then you'd expect to get increase in the membrane potential, which does not lead to an increase in the firing rate in a specific position in the space, because if you superpose a bunch of frequencies different, you get a big peak and then you get this little peak. Due to inhibition, they don't lead to firing.
Clearly you would have more resolution by doing intracellular recordings. The problem is, of course, as you know, it's one thing is to do intracellular recordings in vivo, which is extremely challenging by itself, doable, but especially in 2D environments, it's very difficult. And to do it in developing animals, is no one has been able to that yet. So wait a little bit. Okay, so are there other spatial inputs? And yes, there are, because in the first studies, we were not able to find border cells, because they are, also in adults, they're quite uncommon. It's about maybe 10% of the cells we record in layer two. But now we have more data. So in a study where Thale Bjerknes has recorded a lot of data from young animals, it's very clear that there are border cells right from the beginning, and they look pretty adult-like also right from the beginning. So this is an example at P17. You introduce a wall here and you get a copy of the field along that wall as well. Remove the wall and also even you get that little trace here, which is quite common. You do it the same here, you see. So it's these cells are there from the beginning and apparently in the same percentages as in the adults. So so that means that in the young animals, you have adult-like border cells, but you do not have adult-like grid cells. And I just pull up this to make Neil happy, because this is a model that he presented in his talk, so I will not repeat it. But the essential idea is that from hypothesized cells in the cortex, for example, entorhinal cortex, that respond to boundaries of the environment, you may add up those inputs and you should be able to get place fields as a result of it. So this was suggested before those cells were observed and also before grid cells. But they could at least account for firing along walls or boundaries in the hippocampus. Whether they account for firing out in the field is maybe less certain, because in the hippocampus, unlike the cubiculum, we do not frequently see fields that are away from the borders. They really stick to the borders. But anyway, it introduces the idea that border cells are present and may be perhaps the origin, or at least one origin of place activity in the hippocampus.
So,
which inputs, what are the inputs in the adult brain? And this is published material, so I won't really go much into it, but we used optogenetic methods to try to find out. So this started in 2008, at that time, optogenetics was still young, so we had to develop the viruses ourselves. And there were two Chinese couple who helped us with that, Shengya Zhang and Jingyi. They were able to make AV viruses that that were transported retrogradely through the axon back to the soma. So we could use those to inject the virus first with the flag tag, which allows them to be identified under fluorescent microscope. So inject those into the hippocampus. This is rat brain, sagittal section. This is the hippocampus. And not surprisingly, cells in the hippocampus are labeled. But more interestingly, also cells in regions that project to the hippocampus are labeled. And one of those is the medial entorhinal cortex. You will also see a few others, like the claustrum and other areas that are really remote, which have direct projections into the hippocampus. So it very efficiently labels, and the reunions also, efficiently labels cells that have projections into the hippocampus, because it's taken up by the axon and then somehow transported back and expressed in the soma. So, but now the point. So, what's interesting is not only to see those cells, but the virus also carries the gene for channel rhodopsin 2, which makes it possible to identify those cells by not only implanting tetrodes in the entorhinal cortex at the usual place, but also implanting an optic fiber just above the tetrodes. And through this optic fiber, we can then deliver light pulses. And the idea is that those cells that express the channel rhodopsin will then respond with minimal latencies each time there is a light pulse. So it's a way to identify the cells, and we can then ask, for example, whether grid cells are light responsive, and in other words, project into the hippocampus. And yes, they do. Grid cells project to the hippocampus, perhaps not very surprising, but it shows that the method works. So this is a grid cell. Recorded when the rat is walking in the box, and this is the response of the cell to light pulses. So it's 3.5 millisecond light pulses delivered into the layer 2 of the medial entorhinal cortex. And this here is a raster diagram, or actually it doesn't even look like one, because the response is so sharply tied to at the same latency. So the latency is 9.0 seconds in this case from the beginning of the light pulse, and each time from on about 130 trials, the cell responds at exactly 9.0 milliseconds. This is just a frequency distribution, so you see again the same. So this is a grid cell that responds at what was a minimal latency in our sample. This is a border cell, which also did the same. So again, now this cell doesn't respond on every single trial, so therefore you see the dots here. But again, it's always at the same latency. Now it's 9.2 milliseconds. And you can see that's a border cell because it fires consistently on the right side of the wall.
You're able to identify where in the hippocampus
it projected? No. So the virus was injected into the entire dorsal hippocampus, so it could be anywhere there. So the method wouldn't allow for more specificity. So we are working on that, but that's with completely different methods. Can say more about it. Yeah. And finally, there were also some head direction cells. So not the ones that are really sharp, but those that are more broadly tuned. Which then also have projections into the hippocampus, fire at 8.3 milliseconds. And
this is just
the group data. So again, latency on the x-axis. On the y-axis, we now have cell number, and color indicates firing rate. And then I put white lines on top just to help you see the firing latencies. So the peak latency is exactly the same for at least 30 of those cells, and then a subset of the cells have longer latencies, probably because they are indirectly activated. But the latencies are about the same, both for the grid cells, for the border cells, and for the head direction cells, and even for a large bunch of non-spatial cells, which we don't know are. At that time, we didn't analyze for speed cells, but they at least could be a subset of these cells. So many questions come up, of course, whether these are directly activated, since it's minimal latencies, and we never see shorter latencies. And because if you stimulate across known synapses, you get much, much longer latencies. Then I'm pretty confident it is, but that's all in the paper, so I don't want to deal with that. What I rather want to deal with is the possible implications for hippocampal or for grid-to-place relationships and other relationships between these cell types. So now we know then that there aren't only grid cells, but there are also border cells and probably a few head direction cells and maybe even speed cells that project into the hippocampus. So the hippocampus gets a multitude of inputs. Some of these, like the border inputs, are obviously important for defining firing along borders, at least in the hippocampus. And there are certain place cells that fire specifically along borders, like Bob Muller has shown that. And I think you showed it to Neil, didn't you, or Colin, also in the hippocampus. It wasn't only subiculum, but also in hippocampus, wasn't it?
Well, I think place cells, you know, are everywhere, although, as Bob Muller showed, they get more frequent and more narrow, you know, to the border.
Yeah, but sometimes if you introduce a wall, for example, you may, for example, replicate the field same way. So there is some match between at least a subset of the cells. What is an but at the same time, the grid cells provide another type of input which may be useful, which is more related to the metrics of spatial navigation distances, and especially out in the field, you could imagine that they might be more important. So that's still hypothetical, but there are lots of inputs that may be important both for path integration and for geometrical relationships. And the outcome, the place cell firing, is probably a combination of both. Yeah.
Maybe I missed it, but was the fire signified by all cell types, or just pyramidal cells, or interneurons?
They are taken up by many cell types. So they are taken up by stellate cells. That's obvious if you see them from histology. Probably also the pyramidal cells, and also a minor component of interneurons, even long-range interneurons.
In the
entorhinal cortex, in the hippocampus.
What cells is it affecting in the hippocampus?
Everything. That's some caution about that, because some cells don't like to take up viruses. Like, I think it's more difficult in CA3 and in dentates. So, yeah.
Well, we heard last week the point of view that some sensory inputs, other than those that come through grid cells, are at least as important in driving place cells, and that in fact you can abolish grid cell firing and still get place cell firing. So when you say that grid cells are the major spatial input, what does that exactly mean? What is this statement based on?
Yeah, well, first of all, the statement was not that they are the major input. They are most of the cells that we... Yeah, no. Okay, yeah, okay, sorry. I can tell you where it comes from. 45 cells here, 12 here. But major then refers to number of cells, so it's quite likely that there are more, a larger number of grid cells. But the proportion is, if you count the proportions, the border cells are as important.
Out of the inputs from the entorhinal cortex, it's the major that
they're going to. Yeah.
Other inputs which are not from the entorhinal cortex, you cannot say what is the
important. Yeah. No, but they are, there are limitations with the virus technique, because it also depends. Maybe some types of cells take up virus more easily than others. But if you disregard that, the data do suggest that grid cells are the most important. But that doesn't mean that the others are not important. So, perhaps you don't need so many border cells. As long as they contact a large number of the place cells, perhaps fine. I have no idea. But regardless, grid cells respond to self-motion. That's very clear. But also, as I suggested yesterday, they're also completely dependent on other types of input. So, and not the least, I mean, I'm only talking about medial entorhinal cortex. Lateral entorhinal cortex provides a lot of other inputs, and those are very different. So, I'll come back to that a little bit later. All right. So when you go back to these multiple inputs, then what does that mean? So it's not necessarily the case that those inputs are the same all the time. On the contrary, actually, that's maybe quite unlikely. So could it be that over time the contribution of different types of cells may vary? That's one possibility. Perhaps different modules of grid cells may interact at different times, also possible. Perhaps this varies across cells. Maybe some cells receive more of one type than another type. It's also possible. But I thought it can be useful to compare this with data from another system, from the visual cortex, again. So if you go back now to some work that has been published during the last 3-4 years in the visual cortex, especially on orientation-tuned cells, you may get some hints. So this is work from a figure from a paper from the Connaught lab, in which they were able to record inputs on spines on different parts of the dendrites with a calcium imaging technique at the same time as they were able to patch and record the output of the cell electrophysiologically. So they had both a variety of inputs onto the same cell and the output. And this shows responses to different orientations of gratings. And you can see that that different parts on the dendrite, different spines, have different preferences. So this is quantified here, which captures the point. So now we have orientation selectivity and the distribution of that within the cell, which can be, in their hands, quite broad. But when you compare that with the selectivity of the outputs, they tend to be have a much stronger tuning. So this first paper from the Connaught lab had very few cells, but it has more recently been at least partly confirmed by a paper generated from the Svoboda lab with a much larger sample, and where they do show that although for the inputs there is a bias to what actually becomes the output, the variation is much larger across the inputs. So this suggests then that we should not disregard that there may be quite sophisticated computational mechanisms at the postsynaptic stage or in the local circuit of the hippocampus, which contribute to the selectivity of the place cells. So we may have inputs from a variety of types of cells in the entorhinal cortex, or maybe even of grid cells of all kinds of preference phases or several orientations and so on. But which ones actually have an influence at any given time may not be so easy to predict out of anatomy alone. So there may also be temporal mechanisms, and perhaps what is influential at one point of time may not be the same that is influential at a different time. So if there is such a gating taking place over time, what could be the mechanisms for this? And a common view is that neuronal oscillations contribute importantly to this. So oscillations, as we have heard, take place across a wide variety of frequency ranges, but gamma oscillations may be particularly important for this, which I'll try to explain very briefly in this cartoon, which is from Wolf Singer, and later was also reproduced by Pascal Fries in a review paper. And the idea is simply that that gamma oscillations, if you have two brain areas, A and C, and if they oscillate in synchrony, both at the same frequency and at a similar phase, so they go up and down in conjunction, that creates windows of opportunity where they both are close to firing threshold and can influence each other. So this is what they call a good phase relationship, because cells in A can easily influence C, and cells in C may influence A. So this is in contrast to a condition where you compare cells in A, which fluctuate like this, like in the red wave, and in B, which also fluctuates, maybe at the same frequency even, but it's out of phase compared to C. And if that is the case, if those peaks are at different times, then the opportunities for interaction are much less. So this is what they call a bad phase relationship. So the idea is simply that that oscillations and gamma oscillations may bring cells close to firing threshold at similar times so that they can easily influence each other, meaning that you may have a lot of different anatomical inputs to a brain area, but which ones are active at any given time, that may depend on whether they are in phase or out of phase relative to the local oscillations. So it's a way to select inputs out of the many possible inputs to a brain area.
And nothing special about gamma, right?
Oh, yeah, good that you mentioned that. I forgot that. Why is gamma better? Well, there's nothing in principle that's special about gamma, but there are a few nice things. And one of the nice things is what I show here, namely that gamma goes on and off. It's just the short periods, whereas theta, at least in the rat, is all the time. So it's not so useful. Gamma, you can really select windows. And this is just a figure, a cartoon from a paper when Laura Colgin was in our lab. And what she did was that she recorded from CA1 at the same time as CA3 or at the same time as medial entorhinal cortex, and found that CA1 oscillated or alternated between periods when it was highly coherent with activity in the medial entorhinal cortex in the fast gamma range, and periods when it was coherent with the CA3 in the slow gamma range. So slow and fast gamma sort of alternated, sometimes several times per second, and sort of created windows short windows that were either synchronous or coherent with entorhinal cortex, medial entorhinal cortex, or CA3. So suggesting that gamma may, in the hippocampus, create these windows, short windows, when CA1 actually can communicate better with either CA3 or with medial entorhinal cortex. Yeah.
Is there any evidence that if you cut out either CA3 or MEC, then CA1 will either have slower or fast gamma?
If you lesion it, you mean, or?
Mm-hmm. I know there's lesion studies, but I don't know if they're going to
check. Yeah, no, those experiments still haven't been done, so whether it will always be coherent with medial entorhinal when you, I doubt it, but it hasn't been done. Yeah. Yasser, did you have something?
I'm just wondering, where is the causality? I mean, you see that a certain oscillation happens, or a certain synchronization happens when the task is happening, and maybe CA3 is talking to MEC, and then another synchronization happens when MEC is talking to CA3.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And why does that say that that this, maybe it's just a consequence of the fact that these two are talking to each other, not that the gamma has any role in making them?
I wouldn't really say so much about causality. I would just say that this oscillation, this alternation happens. It may even happen spontaneously, or there may be just some random mechanism creating it to go back and forth between slow and gamma, which allows synchronization several times per second with either area A or area B, which may be useful. But I don't think.
I would say useful, then it implies that it is causal, that it is having a use in that word, the crosstalk between these two regions.
Yeah, because.
Whereas it could be that these two regions talk to each other no matter what, and the consequence of that is that, I walk when I talk.
Yeah, but.
It's not that the walking is actually making me talk.
No, but what happens? what happens if you get coherence between two brain areas is that the cells in those two areas will be closer to firing threshold at the same time. So you can infer from that that it's possible, it's more likely they can actually influence each other. So I mean, it's a possibility.
But I think the other way around is more likely, that they are talking to each other, therefore their potentials are happen to be higher. It's not the other way around.
I think it's well recognized in this area that, you know, gamma is likely feedback inhibition from neural firing locally, and that if two populations are talking to each other, then they're likely to synchronize, and so the gamma will likely synchronize, and so even Pascal would agree that which comes first is still an open question.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the membrane potential is also a consequence of firing. So, but again, it also goes back to the other question I have, that there is so much actually circular interactions in this field, and that's quite hard to figure.
Well, I just want to know what is the status of this. This is not a resolved thing in the sense that we don't know what is causing what.
No, I don't want to talk about causality.
But I know that this causing of interaction comes out of interaction, then it can facilitate.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Good. So that was only introduction. So what I want to talk about is the lateral entorhinal cortex, which we so far have large, at least I have largely ignored, so which is a major input to the play cells as well, and which is quite different in many ways. So we know that, I mean, both physiological studies, like the ones that I'm sure Mayank is going to talk about afterwards. True? Yeah. And also behavioral studies, like from the Knierim lab in particular, show that whereas the medial entorhinal cells are spatial, the ones in lateral entorhinal have quite little spatial selectivity, and there's a large literature showing that they are quite responsive to olfactory inputs, which is not surprising given the anatomy, because lateral entorhinal cortex is strongly connected to piriform cortex and olfactory bulb. So that's another type of input that may come into the entorhinal, to the hippocampus, and we then wondered whether those other inputs to the play cells perhaps also could vary over time, whether there are temporal windows where interactions with LEC could be stronger. So in order to find out, we tested animals in an odor task where the rats sniffed in an odor port here, and then they got odor A or odor B. It could be pine or it could be banana. And then one of the odors would then say, odor A would say that reward is to be found here, and odor B would say that reward is to be found there. And showing some below that. So now it gets odor A, has to keep the snout in for 1 second, and then gets odor A again, should go here. Next time it gets odor B. So it's a simple task. But this task allowed us then, so the animals needed about 3 weeks to learn this at the asymptotic levels. Asymptotic levels is more than 85% correct. And I think now it's going to do an error. No, this is not an error. It's just it has to sniff for 1 second. Otherwise, it will not be rewarded. So that, therefore, it didn't get anything. So now it's frustrated. And now it goes back again, odor B. And then that's correct. And finally, I think there will be an error on the next one. Odor B again. OK, then the one after. Oh, I did one. I missed it. Okay, but you get the point.
Error while you're not looking.
Good, but you have the point. Then let's see what happens if you now record simultaneously in CA1 and lateral entorhinal cortex. So recordings were made across the whole transverse range of CA1, including the distal part. And the distal part is the most important, because the distal CA1 is the one that receives the direct inputs lateral and perianal LEC. So this is just a training curve, so you can see percent correct per day, and it comes up to asymptotic levels. Then we call those certain days on this route T1, T2, 3, 4, and 5. And on T5 is when they had reached criterion. And then we ask what is the spectral activity like then. And this is now time on the x-axis, frequency on the y-axis, and then power is color-coded. And then Q sampling here, the orange period, it's 1 second, is when they sniff into the odor port. And what you can see is that that during that second, starting approximately 200-300 milliseconds into the period, which is about the time it takes for the odor to come into the nose, then very prominent activity begins in the 20 to 40 hertz range. So I don't call it gamma because it's quite low. I don't call it beta either because it goes up to 40. So the simplest just to call it 20 to 40. This happens in distal C1, happens in LEC. It does not happen in medial entorhinal cortex.
Yeah, Neil. Okay, it happens in CA3, but this is like the sort of low gamma.
Yeah. No. So we have not recorded in C3. I can't tell, but we have recorded in proximal C1. So if it was a reflection of what came through CA3, you would expect to see the similar thing in proximal and distal, which whereas this is quite unique to the distal. Yeah.
Exactly. You second half of the
Does it take a second for the, is there a reason why there should be the second half?
Yeah, there's a reason, because when the odor delivery begins, it takes some few hundred milliseconds simply for the odors to get into the nose. So that's quite expected.
Is there something significant in UVC? Is it like the first part of the,
You mean this? Or the high one here. Yeah, so this is normal gamma activity, and this actually so if this happens, there is high power gamma activity in the hippocampus, in the medial entorhinal quite often, but it's not really related to the odor sniffing. So here it's present, but can be equally well present in the after and before, when the rat is running, where you more would expect it.
Are they
face locked? The cells are face locked. So.
And then two structures. The two structures.
Yeah, face locked to what? You mean 2040 is face locked to the theta?
Like, and then the two structures.
Yeah, that's the next slide.
A question for the previous slide.
Yes, okay. Okay, take that one first then.
So why is the gamma actually power reducing? It comes up just like that, and then it just goes down.
Slightly goes down, yeah.
Before he has left the port or delivery.
I don't know. Maybe whatever gamma does is most important just as soon as it detects the odor. And it's tempting to speculate that it's related to retrieval of this odor place association, that's very hard to prove. But there are some things I'll show later that may be consistent with that.
Do you have anything where the animal's sniffing in the same way, but where there's no
continuity? Yeah, so that's a control experiment. I'm not going to show it, but I can tell in which they get just pure air on occasional trials in between. And then we measure sniffing, so use thermocouples in the nose, which sense the temperature change, and so you know they are sniffing. So, and despite maintained sniffing, so they sniff just as much as before, there's nothing when there is no odor.
Can I ask you a question related to Manuel's question? Is there any indication of when the animal has made a decision? How do these areas connect to the motor areas that tell the animal if I'm moving towards A or towards B?
Yeah.
Because perhaps once the animal has made a decision, the power decreases.
Yeah. No, so it's a good question. When exactly does the animal decide to go to A or to B?
Right.
So we can only tell from the behavior, which is subsequent.
Because you're forcing the animal to sleep for 1 second. So you don't know exactly. When within that 1 second
So
has already made a decision.
I expect that during that second something has to happen. Otherwise, the animal actually has to retain it to decide. So I think during that second, and probably in the second part, the animal will sort of retrieve the memory that this odor means go to A or go to B. But it can also happen later, which actually there are other data we're also not going to show, which in which you get occasional recurrence of this high power and high coherence thing. Now also when they are going further. Okay. If you watch the video, you might have seen, for example, that in one instance it was on the way to B and suddenly it changed its mind and went to A. So we haven't analyzed those, but could be.
Am I right in seeing that the theta power is pretty much the same during Q sampling and not during Q sampling?
Yeah, it's pretty constant, but it's maintained also.
So he's not moving?
Yeah, we have thoroughly analyzed that because this is things reviewers like, you know. So we have even not only analyzed head movements, that totally fixed, there's no movement at all, but there's also no body movements, so the animal doesn't move like this, so there's
but
nothing.
Is the theta power supposed to increase
with running speed? Yeah, but still, there is still theta power as long as they are attentive and sniffing. So as you can see, it's still maintained. So then to the, sorry.
So since you have the thermocouple, were you able to see if there was any phase locking between the sniffing and the theta?
No, we didn't look at that. But I think it's been reported before that, actually, I don't even know if it's phase locked. I mean, it has theta frequency, but I thought they were quite independent. That's my recollection of those studies. Yeah.
Well, it looks like, although I don't know if it is, the theta during the sniffing is slightly lower frequency than the theta just afterwards.
Yeah.
Transition between
yeah. Yeah. Which is kind of what you would expect, isn't it? So, but now, shall I move on to Kate's question? The coherence. So, yes, if they occur at the same time, both in distal C1 and the lateral entorhinal, and yes, if you measure the coherence, so this coherence is now color-coded, time frequency, you see that there's strong coherence between LEC and C1, but not between distal C1 and MEC, for example, and also not between proximal C1 and LEC. Now, is this related to learning, or is it just a passive reflection of having odors in the nose? So it is dependent on learning, because if you now compare across learning stages from T1 to T5, this is again the coherence spectrum, and you can see that in the beginning there's nothing, and then it slightly develops T3, T4 here, and T5 you have really strong coherence between CA1 and LEC. So it develops with learning.
Error time.
Good question, because that's here.
That was great.
Yeah, so you see, error trials, there's nothing. So on those, there is no, that's very, very consistent. But then you might say, of course, that on error trials, there are fewer of them, it's just a few data. So we downsampled, and if you have the same number of trials at T5, you still have the same, so when it's correct. So it is related to having an error. And also you could say that this is volume conducted, but you do see a slight increase in, significant increase in the phase locking of the cells. So it's very noisy, admit that, but you can see that the distribution of the preference, phase preference of the cells increases with learning and then drops again on error trials, both in C1 and in LEC. But then that raises the question then, if the cells now get more coherent between those brain areas, a possible implication could be that this could influence the development of representations in the distal CA1 or in LEC. Yeah. And we tested that then. So this is, I forgot to say, this is work by Kei Igarashi in our lab. So what he did was that he recorded activity from many cells. This is in different animals, so lumped across animals. So neural number on the y-axis here, time on the x-axis. And then again, you have the Q period here at early stages of learning and late stages of learning. And what he then did was to calculate the selectivity of firing of each cell. So simply by taking the difference between firing in relation to order A and B divided by the sum, which then means that if it's selective to order to one order, it is dark, strongly red, and if it's selective to the other order, it's strongly green. So what you can see is that the number of cells that are either green or red, green or red during the Q period here increases with learning, and you get many more of them at the late stage, like here, again in the second half of the Q period. So this is in distal CA1. It's not present in the proximal CA1, but it's also present in LEC, so you see the same thing again. This develops perhaps even more strongly. Saying at least half of the neurons show preferential activity to one or the other odors.
What's on different? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, one after each other. Okay. Yes, okay.
If you reverse the spatial contingency, what do you think would happen to?
Yeah, good question. So that is another experiment we have, which I also won't show you. But what happens, we haven't reversed it, but what we did is almost the same. We introduced new odors. We did that twice. So each time you do that, then the performance, behavioral performance drops, of course, and the coherence drops, and the selectivity here drops. And then they learn it much, much faster the second time. So over 3 days, it's all back to this. And then we did it the third time. So.
But do the cells retain their spatial selectivity?
Actually, I don't think we analyzed for that. I wouldn't expect that to happen, but I can't say until we have analyzed for it. It is related to the odors. I don't think it's related to space, but this is a valid thing to check, sure. All right.
Was there any change in the sniffing behavior with? Was there any change in the sniffing behavior with learning or any such thing, like the sniffing frequency? Since you're thermocouple, like
No, the sniffing frequency is remarkably constant, so it doesn't. At least under those conditions, it was also in the new learning was stable. I forgot your question, sorry.
I think you answered it. I was just wondering if cells became more order selected in CA1, if a cell was selected to order A, was it order selected the appropriate place?
In addition to this, they are all place cells. So that's important to say, because outside the odor port, they have spatial preferences just like any other CA1 cell.
But if it was selected to order A, was it more? Were there more cells that were in the area that the reward was for?
You mean more out of those cells that had firing at the reward area? Again, that's not something we analyzed, but that's a thing we could do. Sure. Yeah. All right. Then the error trials breaks down again, as I said. So suggesting then that, have to move
so
on.
So the error trials are interesting at this point of whether the cells are representing the location of the reward that's associated with the odor, or representing the odor itself.
Mm.
Or maybe the association between those two things, I guess maybe the latter of what you think.
Yeah, and in what sense do you think this?
Well, so in the error trial, it turns the wrong way, right?
Sure.
You don't see the firing. So that would imply that the cells are going to respond to the location associated with the
area. Good. All right. So then how do these parameters, how these variables develop in relative to each other? So if you compare T1 to T5 and then normalize all of them to set performance at T5 to 100 or to 1 and T1 to 0, you can then see that both the behavior, which is the black line, the number percent correct. The coherence, the blue line, and red is the selectivity of the LEC cells, develop very much in parallel. C1, surprisingly, comes later and only catches up at the end. So I'm not going into what that means, but just try to summarize then. So it means that I think these data show that there may be temporary coupling of hippocampus with inputs, like, for example, the LEC, and we know from before that other times at MEC. So different frequencies may be used to couple to different subsets of cells, maybe areas of the brain under different conditions. And these couplings may enable lots of things. It may enable retrieval of or even the encoding of memories. And encoding maybe because if there is increased connectivity, functional connectivity, between those cells, they are all closer to firing threshold, it also facilitates synaptic plasticity. Okay, now, yeah, sure, Tad.
The question about this that maybe follows along the line of question from the others, that it's not necessarily quite about this exact final point, but I assume you haven't done this, but what do you think would happen if you were to instruct this same behavior with a different modality stimulus? In other words, mm-hmm. the LECs,
Well, I mean, obviously we haven't done those experiments, but at least what has been what's known from other studies before, and especially work from Leslie Kay, is that the odor system from the olfactory bulb all the way to hippocampus uses 20 to 40 hertz oscillations, so I think that. I don't think 20 to 40, and I actually know 20 to 40 hertz is not unique to that pathway. It's also used, I mean, Earl Miller, for example, shows it's used in the between prefrontal and I think it was parietal cortex or whatever. So it's common, but the nice thing with the 20 to 40 hertz is that it allows for really long-range interactions. In that sense, olfaction may be special because it's so slow compared to gamma that you actually can keep some synchrony over very large distances. But then it's also some of those may be lateral and some of those may be medial. So, but I think you can even have. I don't think it may not necessarily be odors, but I think the odor system strongly uses these oscillations because it's so advantageous for that long distance thing. Yeah.
Just like one quick comment. So just about the unit effect, really, the unit selectivity. The one possibility that comes out of the questions is that it could be predictive sequences, right? So it could be that the cell responds spatially, and that what you're seeing during this preparatory cue sampling period is purely spatial sequences that pick with the animals. But it becomes contingent on the
other. Yes. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So you can rule that out either by looking for the place fields and seeing if there's a correlation or spatial reversal.
Yeah, that's possible. Good. Shall I then move on to the next part? So I may have to make some compromises, but in the worst case, I skip the last part. So I'll just present briefly, at least, some very preliminary data from recordings, again, in the hippocampus, which suggests that it's not all about entorhinal cortex, if anyone believed that. So spatial navigation or spatial representation, at least, may involve other systems too. So just to remind you about this is a task that was used especially by Emma Wood and Paul Duchenko when they were in Eichenbaum's lab, which is this famous figure eight task or spatial automation task. So it involves the rat walking through a stem here and then alternating between right trials going back like this, left trials like this, and so on. And what they observed is that on this stem, the common stem here, then firing rates on left turn trials were quite often different, systematically different from those on right turn trials or vice versa. So this is a kind of rate remapping because the firing fields usually occur on the same places but just very much stronger in one trajectory than the other. Questions have been where does this come from or how does it arise, and it hasn't really been resolved at all. Possible inputs could be the LSE, or it could arise maybe in C3 because nearly all of this has been done in C1. So to try to find out, we use the same type of task. Oops. Yeah, you know, just hear very weakly the noise here, but this is just background noise. But you will see that now the cell just fired three spikes here and then goes back here. And next time, when it's going to go this way, it will fire more. So now it will fire five, six spikes, something like that. And then it comes back and will now go here. And next time it will just fire two spikes or something. So on every second trial, it will fire a few spikes versus many spikes. I will just let it pass and then I will continue because you're running out of time. So, okay, but then first observation was, this is Hiroshi Ito's work from our lab, and his first observation was that while this is definitely present in C1, as has been observed before, so this is shown here, an example. So the firing of there's two types of mazes. So in this type of maze, then the rat goes like this, and the firing is on the common stem here, and then you can see that that firing is high on when it takes a right turn afterwards, but low when it takes a left turn. And this is just plotted against position on the stem, and you can see that it's consistently different on left turns versus on right turns. And it's just shown here for all the cells. So this is the strongest, this is position on the stem. Firing rate is color-coded, and this is the high rate trajectory, and this is low rate trajectory. So you see a clear difference between in C1. But in CA3, this is much weaker, as you can see here. So there are, while there are about 50% of the cells change significantly the firing rate on the stem in CA1, this is not case in CA3 because it's only about 20% that do that. And this is plotted here with a box plot. So in CA1, you have the full range of changes in peak firing rate, whereas in CA3, the cells generally don't change very much. And this is a scale from up to 100%, and they change usually just about 10%.
Is it all rate remapping?
No, it's all rate remapping. So if there's also a plot showing just the change in position, which is very, very stable. So, but how are CA3 and C1 different? Well, an obvious difference is that only CA1 receives input from the nucleus reunions. So reunions input is a very strong input to CA1. It's actually of the same magnitude as the entorhinal input, but it has generally been completely ignored. So what Hiroshi did was that he heroically targeted his electrodes to the reunions here in the midline nuclei of the thalamus, hippocampus is up here, and hit. And then he did the same task, recorded from neurons in 60 neurons in reunions while they did the same task, and now see that when they also have significant preferences for either right or left turns. So this is a cell, just look at the stem now, fires very low rate when it subsequently goes right, but high rate when it subsequently goes left. And then you see the difference between the high rate trajectories and low rate trajectories is quite large. And you see examples here. This is a cell that consistently fires a high rate when the rat goes to the left subsequently, and a much lower rate when it subsequently goes to the right. At the same time, as there's no difference in running speed, no differences in head direction, or in the position of the animal, it's really minimal.
When it fires in the right, then it fires later in the diagram on top.
Oh, here?
Yes. In the right.
Yes.
After it has left the common branch.
You mean here? Yes. I think this is variable, so it's probably not a good example. But we haven't really analyzed much what happens on this part of the trajectory. We are, all the analysis focus on the stem, so I can't say so much about it. Not strong. It's quite weak. So I think the only placeness is really that they shift between the left versus right trajectories. Otherwise, they are very weakly modulated in space.
What about their modulation?
Very weak, but it is present, which is perhaps not so surprising because I think the reunions again is connected to receives input from the supramammillary nucleus. All right. So what if you remove the reunions? And since this is another study that lasted 5 years, optogenetics wasn't still present. So you started out with making butynic acid lesions in the reunions, and then saw that if it does that, then the differential activity between left and right disappears. So this is shown with a box plot here. So this is the peak rate from 0 to 100% change. In CA1, this is the full range, whereas in CA3 it's low. And if you make a lesion in in the reunion, CA1 also drops to CA3 level.
And what happened to performance?
They continue to. It's fine. Yeah. In this task, it's nothing detectable. Yeah. But it's a simple task, so I wouldn't say they may be impaired in other things.
Oh, is this continuous automation?
The continuous, yeah, with one exception, comes later.
What's the difference?
I have to
you can introduce delays, for example, and then task gets harder. If you, so that before they choose the next one, they have to wait a little bit. So, yeah.
Then they learn the task before the vision.
Yes, in this case, they are pre-trained, and
The amount of this. Dissociation between two direction movements and unions, was it more or less than CA1?
Between the reunions and CA1?
You said that CA1 had more of the remapping between left and right trajectory than CA1. I'm wondering what about reunions?
It's CA1. Pretty much the same. So you can, I don't have the figure here, but if you compare the percentages, you see 42% of the cells are significantly different between left and right in reunions, and in CA1 it's about 50%. So it's quite strong.
The appearance of this remapping in this, when you put the animal first to start doing this task of learning, do you still see in CA1 this preferential firing?
You mean on the first trial, time ever? No, it takes a while to develop.
So you think it correlates with the performance?
I would think so, but I should emphasize, I mean, this is not something we have tested, so, but I would be surprised if it's present right from the beginning, but that's my guess, yeah. Okay, so lesions, and the same was later shown with optogenetics too, so what Hiroshi did then was to use the same type of viruses that I told about, and then inject them into reunions directly, and then he can apply the laser just above the reunion. So this is the position of the optic fiber, and then the reunions is here, and the virus hits reunions pretty well. And what happens is that if you apply light, it's now not channel rhodopsin, but this is ARCH, which then has an inhibitory effect. And what you can see is that, like the lesion, inhibiting reunions input also abolishes the difference in, or at least reduces the difference in the CA1. So,
is the laser in the units or in CA1?
This, what I show, is directly in the injection is into the reunions, and the virus that is not does not have strong antigrade or retrograde transport, but it can also be done from the CA1. But what I showed is directly.
Was there any other effect on CA1 besides this when the reunions was turned off?
I'm sure there are.
I'm but, wondering if one can.
No, so we try to look a lot for changes in temporal activity, theta oscillations, and all that, and gamma.
Binding rate of cells.
Yeah, not. No, I wouldn't say that, but it didn't really show anything striking. So, we haven't really focused on it, so I don't want to say too much.
That figure right there shows peak rate going down during the night. Is that the peak rate of CA1?
Yeah, this is the peak rate at whatever that happens. Yeah. So you still have the full range, but it goes. And I have to emphasize, the lesions are actually much better in this regard because the reunions looks like a sausage, and it's very, very difficult to hit all of them. So this is actually only a partial inactivation. Works in some animals, but not in others. Okay. So. Where? I mean, what is reunions? It's a small nucleus, so is it doing the whole job alone? Probably not. Reunions is strongly connected to medial prefrontal cortex. The medial prefrontal cortex has two ways to access the hippocampus, either through the entorhinal cortex or through the reunions to the hippocampus. So what Hiroshi then did is that he went one step further back to the medial prefrontal cortex and recorded there, either in the prelimbic area or in the anterior cingulate, and again sees the same thing if you compare now the center, which is here, and the center, which is there. And you can see the big contrast between high rate and low rate trajectories. See it also here. And about 32% of his cells now showed significant changes between trajectories. So it brings us back to prefrontal, and maybe suggest that the reunions is a relay, probably does something more, but on the way from prefrontal to hippocampus. So prefrontal does not directly target the CA1, so it may use reunions for that.
But just to be clear, when you sort into high rate and low rate, that's high rate and low rate in the hippocampus, right?
Yeah. No. You mean, for example, here? This is the high and low rate of the prefrontal cell.
Yeah, that's a little dangerous, isn't it? When you take some arbitrary distribution, sort of high and low, you're going to get something.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, you will always get more activity on the left one than on the right one.
High rate, low rate in the campus. Do you see anything?
Because you don't know who is projecting the bone. So you don't know whether it is a high rate or a low rate.
Yeah. No. So I mean, of course, you will get a difference, but what you will see is this. I mean, you will get significant differences. Not there. Here. Between, if you compare with CA3, for example, you'll also see. Of course, the high rate is higher than the low rate, but the magnitude is much larger for CA1.
But the important point is left versus right. Mm. And so if you lined up left versus right masters, you see. Okay, if you lined up a maximum firing term for each cell versus minimal firing term for each cell, then you'd see on CA1 much more brightness for the maximum firing.
Yes. Yeah. So then.
Sometimes I'm telling you about. My question. For
yes.
Also, in prefrontal.
Shall I go back?
No, here.
Yeah.
So here, more clearly maybe than in the reunions, these cells have the cells in the middle portion of your sorting from, say, 100.
You mean here now?
Yeah.
Yes.
110 to 220 or so.
Yes.
Have reasonable place fields in there.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they do. So, but in prefrontal, I mean, that's not really the area I know most about, but there is spatial selectivity to some extent. I mean, you even get it in visual cortex. So it's just not really like in CA1. But I agree, this is the result. Yeah.
That distance or time on the x-axis? The x-axis is that distance or time?
Yeah, this is position along the stem. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so then what Hiroshi also did is that he tried to predict whether the rat would go left or right on the next one. So he just used used decoding. He made a decoder which just then used the firing rates of the different neurons, which he then weighted. Did that for alternating parts of the trajectory, and then predicted what the firing would be on the other. And for CA1, predictions were much better than for CA3 and CA1 with lesions. But if we now compare it with the error trials, you will see that on the correct trajectories, the predictions were quite good. So in 80% of the cases, he could use the firing of the cells to on the stem to predict where the rat would go in the next trial, so that regardless on where on the stem the animal was, whereas on the error trials, it was not very informative about where the rat would go the next time. Except maybe for the very beginning, but that could actually be a reflection of what the rat did on the previous trial. So what he then finally did was to introduce a delay here. So the rat is then, before it is allowed to go down the stem, it had to wait for a certain amount of seconds. And then again, he did his prediction. And then what he sees is that at the end of the stem, the predictions of what the animal is going to do here, whether it's going to go left or right, increases. But earlier, it's completely a chance, as it is on error trials, which then is consistent with the idea that this activity, at least at the end of the stem, is somehow related to what the animal actually is going to do, whether it's go left and right, and then that this rate difference between left and right has some connection, at least at the end, again, to what the animal is going to choose subsequently. Yeah, sure.
So the animal is alternative, right?
Yes.
So where do you think the memory is stored of what was the previous run? Because that will determine what this run is going to be. Is it the working memory that is somewhere in the frontal cortex? Is it in the hippocampus? What's your...
I would assume that this is, if you look at the figure here, so this is present both in medial prefrontal, and so I would think it's expressed all over, exactly where it originates or how, I don't know.
Do you have any sense of latency in one of the signals coming up earlier than others?
No, we haven't done it. Yeah. Okay, was it Neil?
So on the next slide there, you've shown this in terms of decoding accuracy, but does this mean that when the rat is delayed and then has to make its choice, you do not see reliable splitter cell activity except right at the end of the rat? Because this is a controversy in splitter cell world.
No, I think.
Yeah. Said that you don't see splitter cell activity except in this continuous running.
Mm-hmm. No.
Which means maybe they're trajectory cells rather than choice cells.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of expression around them.
Well, I mean, Ainge, he did this, and they showed that they get the splitters on continuous ones, but not on delayed trials, except that just sometimes they see you splitting during the delay period.
I thought they got it on late. Didn't Bruce also do this, that they introduced delays? And I mean, they got it, I thought, but what mattered was whether it became hippocampus dependent as you introduced the delays. Or? But you know this better than I. I'm not really so familiar
with it. Yeah, I mean, with Ainge, I'm pretty sure that they stopped seeing the splitter cells on the stem when they did the delay period.
But that could then be in this part of the stem, here. So that may be the difference.
Your decoding plot could actually just show the absence of splitter activity.
Yeah.
So right there, when it's actually made with its turn.
Yeah.
Which again, is important for interpreting what splitter cell activity is. Is it a sort of motoric trajectory type code, or is it actually, I'm thinking about turning left next?
Yeah.
It seems not to be.
I don't think they saw it at the choice point. I think when they did see anything in the delay pass, it was during the first half of the delay period, it was during the delay period itself rather than on the thing.
Okay, but you see here, I mean, this is not significant, but still, I mean, you see there is this tendency even on the error trials for some activity early on, which then disappears. So, I mean, there could be that there is some retrograde component as well. I don't think they mutually exclude each other.
To Sarah's question, one expectation is that these cells are remembering which way it came from, and that's how it decides which way to go.
And then information will be there at the beginning.
And then it might decay away before it gets to
the end. Yeah, but then if that were all, you wouldn't really expect that to. I mean, here on the delay trials, then I think you would expect that to disappear. Yeah. Okay, good. So I'll use the last 5 minutes then to talk about something completely different. That will be a real rush, so I don't know if it makes any point. But I can rush because it's based on what we talked about yesterday, namely the possible role of grid cells to place memories. I said that grid cells are very rigid. I don't want to say more than that. But also, this is very different from place cells, which show a phenomenon we call remapping, two types of remapping. One is rate remapping, which I just talked about. That can also be expressed when they work in two-dimensional environments. Then between two tasks, for example, the white box and the black box, the rate is different, but firing locations are the same. But the other one, which I will focus on, is a task where the firing is, first of all, quite often different subsets of cells are active in the two conditions, for example, in room A and room B, or in two boxes that are very different. And if they are active, the cells are active in both, they typically tend to be active in different places. So it's a very different code from the rigid one of the entorhinal cortex. But if you now go to the entorhinal cells, what happens then? Do the same types of tasks, not so easy to see by eye, but if we cross-correlate the firing rate maps of the cells, then you can see some interesting things. So this is a study from 2007 when Marianne Finn was in the lab, and what these cross-correlations show is that, first of all, not surprisingly, if you cross-correlate rate maps from two tests in the same environment, then you get the grid pattern centered on the grid, which is just means that the cells are stable. But if you cross-correlate the firing rate map in one environment, A, with the firing rate map in a different environment, maybe a circle in the same place, and do that for every single cell, you will see that the cross-correlation map is shifted, in this case, to the right, similarly in every single cell. So they all go together. And it's even so that if you do the analysis for all the cells you record at the same time, then you still get a nice cross-correlation map. It's just shifted. So in this case, all the cells were shifted to the right. In this case, they were all shifted a little bit up to the left. And in this case, a little bit down. So these are three different animals. And at that time, we didn't have modules, but still all the cells were recorded at the same place. So probably most of them were from the same module. So very rigid. And for when rats are tested in different environments, then the whole ensemble of cells sort of shifts coherently. OK, now I'll skip the rest because I won't have time. But I do want to get to the modules. This just reminds us about yesterday. But then asking, could this remapping be differential across environments? And this is just published data from the Stensula paper, where a box, a rectangular box, was changed to a square box, was changed to a rectangular box, similar to the Barrett paper from Kate and from Neil, where also, as in that task, cells were shown to compress their firing rate maps with the environment. If you look at those four cells here, but you see 1, 2, 3, 4 peaks, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. But not in all modules. In other modules, and these smaller modules like this, there's actually no change at all. So if you compare this map here, it is exactly the same as up here. So if you correlate the maps, you take this map and then pull it out sequentially in small steps and ask when do you get the maximum correlation. You get the maximum correlation by doing nothing for this module, whereas for this larger modules, you have to pull it all the way back to get the maximal correlation, meaning that these modules actually respond to the change of the wall by showing some sort of compression of the map, whereas this does not. The important point here is not why, but it is that the modules do something different in relation to changes in the geometry of the environment. And that then introduces what will be my last slide, namely, which is this is work we did also in 2007 together with Alessandro Treves, who made a little model based on a pattern on the dress of his daughter. But it's meant to show that you have these different modules, which Alessandro already imagined at that time, and they feed into the hippocampus. And the point is that if they do their independent things, then you actually have a way to generate different combinations of activity onto place cells in the hippocampus, which then is a way that you can actually get many different patterns of activity, and this could then give rise to rate mapping, which is of course extremely useful for any system that wants to store large amounts of memory. Yeah, Neil?
In this type of experiment though, typically the place cells do a parametric sort of change rather than showing remapping. In your situation, they didn't show global remapping, I don't know, but
usually when you just... No, that's true. So, I mean, as you know, I mean, whether you get remapping or not is almost impossible to predict. It may even vary in the same paradigm between animals. So in this task that we used, I mean, in the task from the 2007 paper, that was a box, a square box, and a circular box in the same place, which under some circumstances of training, when we used the same box and everything was similar, they only rate remapped. Under other circumstances, when we used different boxes, probably with different odors, as Kate also has shown, then they actually do show global remapping. So I think, at least I'm not able to tell in advance whether it will do one or the other, but the system
just
does.
Change, yeah. Move one of the walls of the box. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in this.
Typically, you see some parametric boundary vector cell model type changing in place cell parameters. You could, there are some changes of rate there, but it's not typically
remapping. No, you don't know. I mean, it can remap.
It could have done those rats.
Yeah, sure. So I think the experiment that has to be done, and which you actually are going to do, is to do this with simultaneous recordings in hippocampus and entorhinal, and only then we'll really know what the relationship is. So let me then, since I'm probably almost over time, just mention that there are many people involved. I mentioned some of them. So I mentioned Kay, who did the 2040 Hertz, Kay Igarashi, the 2040 Hertz work. Hiroshi Ito, who did the reunions work, Shengjia Chang and Jing Ye, the optogenetics work, and Tarle Bjerknes, who did recordings from border cells in young animals, and the rest of the people I mentioned yesterday too, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
A couple of minutes for discussion.
Oh, okay. All right.
Can I just ask you about the last, the remapping scenario? So you're saying that when you get global place cell remapping, you get dissociated modular responses. Is that what you're saying?
So this is what you're asking about, isn't it? So.
No, not the rescaling. Just the.
No, so I mean, again, I mean, that experiment hasn't been done. So ideally, you see, what we know, I give you what the knowledge we have, is that when you get global remapping in the, when you get global remapping in the hippocampus with simultaneous recordings from medial entorhinal cortex and entorhinal cortex, Global remapping is always accompanied by some sort of shift in the grid cells, in the phase and possibly the orientation of the grid cells. When you get only rate remapping, then you never get the shift. So this is what I didn't show you here. So then the cross correlations are always centered on zero. So that is what we know.
So my question then is about the change in orientation. So is the change in orientation necessary for this to work?
No. I don't think it's very critical. So, and the two reasons. First is that there aren't that many orientations, but there's maybe still sufficient jitter. One thing I haven't talked about is that the grids are asymmetric, so that may also perhaps give sufficient jitter. But the other thing is that there have been groups trying to address this in with a computational approach. So it's a study, Monaco et al., from Larry Abbott's lab, where they compared the effect of, where they had something like four or tested the effect of 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, modules that either change in grid phase or in grid orientation. And what gave the most largest amount of remapping in their analysis was definitely the phase, not the orientation. So I don't think it is that critical.
Relative to each other, though, that's not this effect.
No, this is phase changes between them.
Yeah, between modules.
Yeah. Whereas within module, it's always consistent.
But these data, you didn't show any changes between
modules. No, so the experiment that yet has to be done is to record in and under conditions when you get global remapping in the hippocampus and have several modules present in the data. And that's, as you can imagine, it's not so easy, but it's doable. I will come. Yeah.
All right, so we meet at, sorry?
No, before we disperse, we didn't do it yesterday, but it's a lot of new faces this week. I'm sure you guys are all hippocampal people and you all know each other, but I see a lot of people that I don't know. So could we go around?
Yes, we can, but let Edward sit down if he wants
to. Of course.
He's been up for 1.5 hours.